Job 5. The trace was unmistakable. Job sat at his console as the readings crawled across his holocube, his heart thundering away with fear and hope. He had spent most of his first 4 months on Earth in darkened movie theaters, sitting through the same films a dozen times, reinforcing his English and broadening his grasp of human cultural nuances as reflected in their fiction. He'd learned to love their movies, especially Westerns. And his favorite part had always been when the cavalry came thundering over the hill, all its banners flying. The network flew no banners. Still, Job thought he could hear the faint sound of bugles and the pounding of hoofbeats in those spiderly twists of light within his holocube. Tachyons. Bugles and tachyons. His observation satellites had detected a wash of tachyons, and that could mean only one thing. A starship in near-Earth orbit. Deliverance was at hand. Now the satellite swept the skies for the source. It was not the swarm mother, Jubin knew that. The mother crept between the stars at speed slower than light. Time was nothing to her. Only the civilized races used tachyon-drive starships. If Akedmi had gotten off a transmission before the single ship was smashed from the skies, if the master trader had decided to check on human progress earlier than planned, if the mother had somehow been detected by some new technology undreamed of when Jubin began his assignment on Earth, if, then it might well be the opportunity up there, the network returned to deliver this world with only the means and price yet to be determined. It would not be easy even then, but of the ultimate result he had no doubt. Jub smiled as his satellites probed and his computers analyzed. Then the holocube turned violet, and his smile died. He made a low, gurgly sound deep in the back of his throat. The sophisticated sensors in his satellites stripped away the screens that cloaked the starship from human instrumentation and displayed its image within the ominous violet of the cube. It revolved slowly, etched in lines of red and white light like some terrible construct of fire and ice. The readouts flashed below the image, dimensions, tachyon output, course. But everything Jube needed to know was written on the lines of the ship, written in every twisted spire, proclaimed by every fanciful excrescence, trumpeted by every baroque whirl and projection, shouted in that panoply of unnecessary lights. It looked like the results of a high-speed collision between a Christmas ornament and a prickly pear. Only the Tachyzians had such rococo aesthetics. Jube lurched to his feet. Tachyzians! Had Dr. Tachyon summoned them? He found that hard to believe, after all the years the doctor had spent in exile. What did it mean? Had Tachis been monitoring Earth all this time, observing the wildcard experiment even as the network had? If so, why had Jubin found no trace of them until now? And how had they managed to conceal themselves from Akedmi? Would they destroy the Swarm Mother? Could they destroy the Mother? The opportunity was roughly the size of Manhattan Island, and carried tens of thousands of specialists representing countless species, cultures, castes, and vocations, merchants and pleasurers, scientists and priests, technicians, artists, warriors, envoys. The Tachyzian craft was a tiny thing. It couldn't possibly hold more than 50 sentients, perhaps only half that number. Unless Tachyzian military technology had progressed astronomically in the last 40 years, what could that little thing hope to do, alone, against the devourer of worlds? And would the Tachyzians even care about the lives of their experimental animals? As Jubin stared at the outlines of the ship with mounting rage and confusion, his phone rang. For an instant he thought insanely that somehow the Tachyzians had found him out, that they knew he was looking at them and had rung him up to castigate him. But that was ridiculous. He slammed a thumb into the console, and the holocube went dark as Jube thumped into the living room. He had to detour around the tortured geometries of the half-built tachyon transmitter that dominated the center of the room like some massive piece of avant-garde sculpture. If the thing didn't work when he powered it up, Jube planned to title it Joker Lust and sell it to some gallery in Soho. Even half-assembled, its angles were curiously deceptive, and he was always bumping into it. This time he dodged around it neatly and took the phone from Mickey's hand.
"Hello?"
he said, trying to sound his normal, jovial self.
"Jubal, this is Chrysalis."
It was her voice, but he had never heard her sound quite like this. She had never called him at home before, either.
"What's wrong?"
he asked her. He'd asked her to procure another batch of microchips last week, and the edge in her voice made him afraid her agent had been apprehended.
"Jay Ackeroy just phoned. He hasn't been able to report until now. He found out a few things about the people who hired Darlingfoot."
"But that's good. Has he located the bowling ball?"
"No, and it's not as good as you think. I know this sounds insane, but Jay says these people were convinced that body was extraterrestrial in origin. It appears they hope to use the corpse in some kind of disgusting ritual to gain power over that alien monster out there."
"The Swarm Mother,"
Jube said in astonishment.
"Yes," Versalis said crisply. "Jay says they're tied in somehow. He thinks they worship that thing. Look, we shouldn't be talking about this over the phone."
"Why not?"
Jube asked.
"Because these people are dangerous," Versalis said. "Jay is coming to the palace tonight to give me a full report. Be there. I'm folding my cards on this one, Jubal. You can deal with Jay directly from now on. But if you'd like, I'll ask Fortunato to drop by. I think he'd be interested in what Jay has turned up."
"Fortunato?"
Jube was horrified. He knew Fortunato mostly by reputation. The tall pimp with the almond-shaped eyes and bulging forehead was a familiar sight at the Crystal Palace. But Jube had always made it a point to avoid him. Telepaths made him nervous. Dr. Tachyon never went into a mind without good reason, but Fortunato was another matter. Who knows how and why he might use his powers, or what he might do if he found out what Jube the Walrus really was.
"No,"
he said hurriedly.
"No, absolutely not. This has nothing to do with Fortunato."
"He knows more about these Masons than anyone else in the city,"
Chrysalis said. She sighed.
"Well, you're paying for this funeral, so I suppose you get to pick the casket. I won't say a word. We'll talk after closing."
"After closing?"
Jube repeated. She hung up before he could think to ask her what she had meant about Masons. Jube knew about the Masons, of course. He'd done a study of human fraternal organizations a decade ago, comparing the Shriners, Knights of Columbus, Oddfellows, and Freemasons with each other and with the bonding brotherhoods of the Thedentian Moons. Reginald was a Mason, Jube seemed to recall, and Denton had tried to join the Elks, but they'd turned him down because of his antlers. What did the Masons have to do with anything? That day Jube was too uneasy to joke. Between Swarm Mothers, Takesian warships, and Masons, he hardly knew who to be afraid of. Even if the cavalry did come charging over the hill, Jube thought, would they be able to recognize the Indians? He glanced up at the sky and shook his head. When he locked up for the night, he made his deliveries to the Funhouse and the Chaos Club, then decided to cut short his swing through Jokertown and head over to the Crystal Palace as soon as possible. But first he had to make one final stop at the Precinct House. The desk sergeant took a daily news and flipped to the sports page, while Jube left a Times and a Jokertown cry for Captain Black. He was turning to leave when the plainclothesman saw him.
"Hey, fat boy,"
the man called out.
"You got an informer?"
He had been slouching on the bench along the tiled wall, almost as if he'd been waiting for someone. Jube knew him by sight, a scruffy, nondescript sort with an unpleasant smile. He'd never bothered to tell Jube his name, but he did show up at the newsstand once in a while to help himself to a tabloid. Sometimes he even paid. But not tonight.
"Thanks,"
he said, as he accepted the copy of the National Informer that Jube offered him. "Did Takesians invent herpes?" the banner screamed. It gave Jube a bad turn. Underneath, another story asked if Sean was about to jilt Madonna for Peregrine. The plainclothesman didn't even glance at the headlines. He was staring at Jube oddly. The corner of his mouth twitched in a quirky little smile.
"You're just an ugly joker boy, aren't you?"
the cop asked. Jube gave an ingratiating, tusky grin.
"What, me ugly? Hell, I got bigger tits than Miss October."
"I've wasted enough time without listening to your asshole jokes," the plainclothesman snapped. "But what did I expect? You're not too bright, are you?"
"Bright enough to fool your kind for 34 years, Jube thought, but he didn't say it.
"Well, You know how many jokers it takes to turn on a light bulb, he said.
All your greasy joker ass out of here, the man said.
Jube waddled to the door. At the top of the stairs, he turned back and yelled,
That paper's on me!
Before taking off for the Crystal Palace. It was early tonight, and the palace was still crowded. Jube took a stool all the way at the end of the bar, where he could put his back right up against the wall and see the whole room. It was Sasha's night off, and Lupo was tending bar.
What'll it be, Walrus?
He asked, long red tongue lolling from one corner of his mouth.
Pina colada, Jube said. Double rum.
Lupo nodded and went off to mix it. Jube looked around carefully. He had an uneasy feeling, as if he were being watched. But who? The taproom was full of strangers, and Chrysalis was nowhere in sight. Three stools away, a big man in a lion mask was lighting a cigarette for a young girl whose low-cut evening gown displayed ample cleavage from three full breasts. Further down the bar, a huddled shape in a gray shroud stared into his drink. A slender, vivacious green woman made eye contact when Jube glanced at her and slid the tip of a pink tongue provocatively across her lower lip. At least it might have been provocative to a human male. But she was obviously a hooker, and he ignored her. Elsewhere in the room, he saw Yin Yang, whose two heads were having a spirited argument, and old Mr. Cricket, too. The floater had passed out and was drifting about near the ceiling again. But there were so many faces and masks Jube did not recognize. Any one of them might be Jay Ackroyd. Chrysalis had never said what the man looked like, only that he was an ace. He might even be the man in lion mask who, Jube noted with a glance, had now slipped an arm around the three-breasted girl and was brushing his fingertips lightly along the top of the breast on the right. Lupo mopped the bar, spun down a coaster and put the pina colada on top of it. Jube had just taken his first sip when a stranger slid onto the bar stool beside him.
Are you selling those newspapers?
Sure am.
Good.
The voice was muffled by his mask, a bone-white death's head. He wore a black cowled cape over a threadbare suit that did very little for his skinny, hollow-chested body.
I'll take a cry, then.
Jube thought there was something unpleasant about his eyes. He looked away, found a copy of the cry, handed it over. The cowled man gave him a coin.
What's this?
Jube said.
A penny,
the man replied. The penny was larger than it should have been, and a vivid red against Jube's blue-black palm. He'd never seen anything like it.
I don't know if...
Never mind,
the man interrupted. He took the penny out of Jube's hand and gave him a Susan B. Anthony dollar instead.
Where's my change, Walrus?
He demanded. Jube gave him back three quarters.
You shortchanged me,
the man said nastily when he pocketed the coins.
I did not,
Jube told him with indignation.
Look me in the eye and say that, you two-bit jerk.
Behind the skull-faced man, the door opened and Troll ducked through into the taproom, followed by a short, red-haired man in a lime-green suit.
Turkey on,
Jube said with apprehension, suddenly reminded of the Takesian warship up in orbit. Jube's unpleasant companion twisted his head around so sharply that his cowl flopped down, revealing thin brown hair and a bad case of dandruff. He jerked to his feet, hesitated, and rushed for the door as soon as Tachyon and Troll had moved toward the back.
Hey!
Jube called after him.
Hey, mister! Your paper!
He'd left the cry on the bar. The man went out so quickly he almost caught the end of his long black cape in the door. Jube shrugged and went back to his pina colada. Several hours and a dozen drinks later, Chrysalis had still not made an appearance. Nor had Jube spotted anyone who looked like he imagined this popinjay might look. When Lupo announced last call, Jube beckoned him over.
Where is she?
He asked.
Chrysalis?
Lupo asked. Deep red eyes sparkled on either side of his long, hairy snout.
Is she expecting you?
Jube nodded.
Got stuff to tell her.
Okay,
Lupo said.
In the red room, third booth from the left. She's with a friend.
He grinned.
Pretend you don't see him, if you hear what I'm saying.
Whatever she wants,
Jube thought the friend had to be Popinjay, but he didn't say anything. He lowered himself carefully off the stool and went to the red room, off to the right of the main tap room. Inside it was dim and smoky. The lights were red, the thick shag carpeting was red, and the heavy velvet drapes around the booths were a deep, rich burgundy. Most booths were empty at this time of night, but he could hear a woman moaning from one that was not. He went to the third booth from the left, pulled back the drape, and stuck his head inside. They had been talking in low, earnest tones, but now the conversation broke off abruptly. Chrysalis looked up at him.
"Jubal," she said crisply. "What can I do for you?"
Jube looked at her companion, a compact, sinewy white man in a black t-shirt and dark leather jacket. He wore the plainest of masks, a black hood that covered everything but his eyes.
"You must be Popinjay,"
Jube said, before he recalled that the detective did not like to be called by that name.
"No,"
the masked man replied, his voice surprisingly soft. He glanced at Chrysalis.
"We can resume this conversation later, if you have business to transact."
He slid out of the booth and walked off without another word.
"Get in,"
Chrysalis said. Jube sat down and pulled the drapes closed.
"Whatever you have for me, I hope it's good."
She sounded distinctly annoyed.
"Have for you?"
Jube was confused.
"What do you mean? Where's Popinjay? Shouldn't he be here by now?"
She stared at him. Sheathed in transparent flesh and ghost-gray muscles, her skull reminded Jube of the unpleasant man who'd sat next to him at the bar.
"I wasn't aware that you knew Jay. What does he have to do with anything? Is there something about Jay that I need to know?"
"The report,"
Jube blurted.
"He was going to tell us about these masons who hired Devil John to steal that body from the morgue. They were dangerous, you said."
Chrysalis laughed at him, drew back the privacy curtains, and rose languidly.
"Oh, Jubal, I don't know how many exotic rum drinks you've indulged in tonight, but I suspect it was a few too many. That's always a problem when Lupo is behind the bar. Sasha can tell when a customer has had enough, but not our little wolf boy. Go home and sleep it off."
"Go home?"
Jube said.
"But what about the body? What about Devil John and these masons?"
"If you want to join a lodge, the Odd Fellows would suit you better, I'd think,"
Chrysalis said in a bored tone.
"Other than that, I don't have the vaguest idea what you're talking about."
The walk home was long and hot, and Jube had an uneasy feeling, as if he were being watched. He stopped and looked around furtively several times, to try and catch whoever was following him, but there was never anyone in sight. Down in the privacy of his apartment, Jube immersed himself gratefully in his cold tub and turned on his television. The late movie was 30 minutes over Broadway, but it wasn't the Howard Hawks version. It was the awful 1978 remake with Jan Michael Vincent as Jet Boy and Dudley Moore doing a comic relief tachyon in a hideous red wig. Jube found himself watching it anyway. Mindless escape was exactly what he needed. He would worry about Chrysalis and the rest of it tomorrow. Jet Boy had just crashed the JB-1 into the blimps when the picture suddenly crackled and went black.
"Hey,"
Jube said, stabbing at his remote control. Nothing happened. Then a hound the size of a small horse walked out of his television set. It was lean and terrible, its body smoke gray and hideously emaciated, its eyes windows that opened on a charnel house. A long forked tail curved up over its back like a scorpion sting and twitched from side to side. Jube recoiled so fast he splashed water all over his bedroom floor and began shouting at the thing. The hound bared teeth like yellow daggers. Jube realized he was babbling in the network trade tongue and switched to English.
"Get out,"
he told it.
"Get away."
He scrabbled over the side of the tub, splashing more water, and retreated. The remote control was still in his hand, if he could reach his sanctum, but what good would that do against something that walked through walls? His flesh went hot with sudden terror. The hound padded after him and then stopped. Its gaze was fixed on his crotch. It seemed momentarily bemused by the forked double penis and full set of female genitalia beneath. Jube decided that his best chance lay in a dash for the street. He edged backward.
"Fat little man,"
the hound called out in a voice that was pure, unctuous malice.
Will you run from me? You sought me out, fool. Do you think your thick joker legs can carry you faster than Sektech, the Destroyer?
Jube gaped.
Who? I am he whose secrets you sought to know,
the Hound said.
Pathetic little joker. Did you think we would not notice? Did you think we would not care? I have taken the knowledge from the minds of your hirelings and followed the trail back to you. And now you will die.
Why?
Jube said. He had no doubt that the creature could kill him, but if he must perish, he hoped at least to understand the reason.
Because you have wasted my time,
the Hound said. Its mouth twisted into obscene, unnatural shapes when it spoke.
I thought to find some great enemy, and instead I find a fat little joker who makes his money selling gossip to a saloon keeper. How much did you think the secrets of our order would be worth? Who did you think might pay for them, walrus? Tell me, and I will not toy with you. Lie, and your dying will last till dawn.
The Hound had no idea what he was, Jubin realized. How could it? It had learned of him from Chrysalis, from the street. It had not walked behind his false wall. Suddenly, for reasons he could not have explained, Jube knew that Sektech must not know. He must lead it away from his secrets.
I did not mean to pry, mighty Sektech,
he said loudly. He had posed as a joker for 34 years. He knew how to crawl.
I beg your mercy,
he said, edging backward toward the living room.
I am not your enemy,
he told it. The Hound padded toward him, eyes smoldering, tongue lolling from its long snout. Jube jumped for his living room, slammed the door behind him, and ran. The Hound bounded through the wall to cut him off, and Jube lost his footing as he recoiled. He went down in a heap. The Hound raised one terrible paw to strike, and stopped as Jube cringed away from the killing blow. Its mouth twisted and ran with phantom slaver, and Jube realized it was laughing. It was staring at something behind him and laughing. He craned his head around and saw only the tachyon transmitter. When he looked back, the Hound was gone. Instead, a frail little man in a wheelchair sat staring at him.
We are an old order, the little man said. The secrets have passed through many mouths, and some have gone astray, and some branches have been lost and forgotten. Be glad you were not killed, brother.
Oh. Yeah,
Jube said, crawling to his knees. He had no idea why he was being spared, but he was not going to argue the point.
Thank you, master. I won't bother you again.
I will let you live, so you may live to serve us,
the apparition in the wheelchair told him.
Even one as stupid and weak as you may have his uses in the great struggle to come. But say nothing of what you have learned, or you will not live to be initiated.
I've forgotten it already,
Jube said. The man in the wheelchair seemed to find that vastly amusing. His forehead throbbed as he laughed. A moment later, he was gone. Jube got to his feet very cautiously. Early the next morning, a joker with vivid crimson skin bought a copy of the Daily News and paid for it with a shiny red penny the size of a half dollar.
I'd keep that if I were you, pal of mine, he said, smiling. I think it might just be a lucky coin.
Then he told when and where the next meeting would be held.